Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
So I wanted to do one of my famous science lessons, and what happened this week was in preparing for this show, I came across an article that I thought was quite interesting, but I realized, you know, we need to roll this back and really talk about how our understanding of cancer has evolved over the years, because I think much of what we're currently doing is not understandable unless you have the background. So let's start out with just defining cancer. And cancer is basically a software error. What do I mean by this? Well, let's go back to the very, very beginning of your life. Mommy had an egg, and that egg got fertilized by your father's sperm. And at that point, you had all the DNA you'll ever need, whether you are a full-grown human who lives to be 100, or whether you are a person who developed cancer and dies prematurely. And that DNA pretty much is what is going to determine either of those two very, very different outcomes. Think about that first single cell. What characteristics does it have? Well, it knows how to divide rapidly, and as it divides, the cells start to change a little bit. Some become top cells, some become bottom cells, right, left, flattens out, folds over, curves in, develops all these infoldings, and before you know it, you have something that resembles an earthworm. And then shortly thereafter, you have something that resembles a salamander, and then you develop the heart and the lungs and the liver and the full gastrointestinal tract and the brain and all the little fingers and fingernails. And so throughout the course of gestation, what's happening is that certain bits of software, let's call that software DNA, is being run for a while and then at some point turned off and packed away, most likely never to be used again. And for the majority of the DNA that is running embryogenesis, that is to say the process of developing from one cell to a baby, most of that DNA is turned off or modified in some way by the time you're born. So in a cancer situation, what's happened is that some of that old software is operating again. Ultimately, it is the mobility of cancer cells that's the root cause of the end organ destruction that kills you. It's not the cancer itself. It's the fact that it invades your lungs. It invades your brain. It invades your bones. It invades your liver and your lungs. And it is the results of those invasions and that tumor growth that most people with cancer die from. So let's walk through the steps of a cancer. First of all, the cell changes and begins running a special kinds of software that allows it to cross walls. It can cross the wall or basement membrane that surrounds the organ. And from there, it has step 2A. I call it 2A because there's a 2B, an alternative. So from there, that cell, which is now capable of moving, goes on a walkabout. And it can either cross into a lymphatic vessel, or it can cross into a blood vessel, and that's path 2A. If it crosses into a blood vessel, you get something called circulating tumor cells, and these occur very early in the process of carcinogenesis, actually. And in fact, one thing that we're looking at very carefully in medicine is this idea that maybe we could take a cancer and we could find it by just doing a blood test every year. So your annual exam might be a blood test that would look specifically for cancer DNA and then say, oops, we've got trouble here because there's cancer DNA in this bloodstream. Now we need to go and track it down. Obviously, that's a more sophisticated thing, and we have to worry about false positives. Those tests would have to be pretty darned accurate. But let's suppose that we could develop that. That could be a real game changer. As it is, doctors are already taking blood samples from people that they know have cancer, finding those cancer cells that are floating around in the bloodstream, and testing them to see about their genetic vulnerabilities. More about that in a moment. There's also step 2B, and 2B is where instead of invading into a blood vessel or lymph vessel, you simply grow locally. Maybe you wrap around the surrounding tissue the way a vine wraps around a tree, or you push into a tissue, possibly blocking it. A lot of primary liver cancers don't show up until the point that they block off the bile ducts and people suddenly turn yellow. And then it's like, oh my goodness, the reason you turned yellow is that the passageway for bile out of your liver has been blocked by a tumor. Not a good way to find it, because those are usually fairly far advanced when they occur. So now you have the local invasion. You have the tumor having gotten somewhere else or grown around something else. But as it starts to grow, it needs to find food and oxygen. Just like living off the land, you know, one person can live off the land pretty easily by hunting or gathering, but the more cells you have, the less that works. So the cancer has to find a place to settle. Ironically, lymph nodes are a common place for these early cancers to settle. But have you noticed you never see, or almost never see, cancers growing inside the blood vessels or the heart? I'm not sure quite why those areas are so inhospitable, but it's an interesting question to ask. So what do you do? You found your place to settle. How can you survive and grow? Well, you can change your nutritional requirements, and many cancers outgrow their blood supply. This creates a stress at the inside of the cancer, which starts to die. At that point, the cells around the dead part change their metabolism, and they revert from needing oxygen to what we call anaerobic metabolism, where they need very little oxygen. Another thing that you have to watch out for is predators. By now, the immune system is looking for you, looking for cancers, and in fact, we probably get cancers to this stage fairly frequently, and then our immune system kills them off before they can really get any traction. So how do you do that? Well, some cancers lose their cell surface markers, these little barcodes that all cells carry on their surface that tell you who and what they are. If they lose those barcodes that reveal them as an outsider, hey, wait a minute, what's a kidney cell doing in my liver? The security guards can't find them. Also, cancers actually start attacking the security systems. They can find somewhere in that DNA that was left over from embryogenesis, they can find the genes that turn off the immune system. Have you ever thought about that? How is it that a woman can grow in her body someone who has different DNA? 50% of the DNA is different. She couldn't accept an organ transplant from her husband. How can she accept a baby? And yet, the body has the instructions, the cells have the instructions to turn off that tissue rejection, and that's exactly what happens in some cancers. They also can produce compounds that inhibit local immunity and turn off T cells in other ways. But more importantly, in order to get really big, tumor cells have to do step 3.4, and that's grow new blood vessels. The process of angiogenesis means having to turn on the growth of new blood vessels. There's a compound called vascular epithelial growth factor that is put out on the body whenever you need more blood flow. Like, for example, if you're trying to heal a wound, you will cause new blood vessels to grow into that area. If you're growing muscles because you're working out, you will cause new blood vessels and enlargement of the existing blood vessels. And we've all seen that, right? The veins popping out on the bodybuilder. But that is due to the production locally of compounds that cause blood vessel growth. And the cancers start producing these same compounds. Step 4 is the exponential growth phase. So once the cancer has an established blood supply and it's figured out its nutritional source, it can begin growing exponentially, 2, 4, 16, 64, and so on, and begin to outcompete local cells for space and nutrition. So now let's talk about how we fight cancer. Now that you understand how cancers operate and what the necessary steps are, you got to remember that early on, our main approach old chemotherapy was to go at step four. Well, these cancers are in an exponential growth phase. They're growing way faster than our other body cells. So let's use something that's a DNA poison. Let's use something that's going to attack rapidly growing cells. And so only the rapidly growing cells will be poisoned. We'll figure out just the right dose, and we'll make the other cells that aren't growing so rapidly pretty darn sick, but we won't kill them. And the cancer cells will die in hordes because they're growing so rapidly they get a bigger dose of the poison. And the problem, of course, is that works to a point, but is difficult to eradicate all of the cancer because not all of the cancer has gotten to step four. Not all of it is in that exponential growth phase. There are other new drugs and strategies that are being developed, and the next segment of this is going to talk about some of those. So let's talk about VEGF inhibitors. I mentioned that vascular epithelial growth factor. Well, we have drugs like bevacizumab, which is a monoclonal antibody that grabs onto VEGF as it's produced and inactivates it. So you make an antibody against something, you can basically erase it because you've gone after the site that's going to act like a key. If I take your keys and I put masking tape around the business end of the key, you are not going to be able to stick that in a lock and turn the lock. And that's exactly how monoclonal antibodies deactivate either the key or, in some cases, the lock. And they're used for a lot of things, and they're very effective drugs. But VEGF inhibitors in particular have really, really been beneficial in treating a whole variety of cancers because they all use this single compound, VEGF, to grow their blood supply. Another strategy is something called chaperone inhibitors. Now, what on earth is that? Well, when RNA is being read by the transcription system in a cell, it basically puts it inside a little, almost like a little ticker tape reader, or you think of it as, you know, think of it as two, as a little factory that opens and closes like a clamshell. So the RNA goes in one end, and a protein, a sequence of amino acids, gets spit out on the other end. But this protein, in order to be active, has to take on a very particular shape. And that shape is determined by the positives and negatives in the amino acids, but also by the presence of these chaperone proteins, which have themselves positive and negative charges, and literally magnetically shift the twist the protein so that something will swing in, like a positive charge will swing close enough to a negative charge that they grab each other. And now the protein has a loop, and that affects where the next positive and negative charge will attach. And so you end up with effectively a very complex structure held together by these positive and negative charges and shaped by the presence of chaperone proteins. So chaperone inhibitors are a big type of anti-cancer therapy. Particularly these heat shock protein 90 inhibitors. But the problems with most of these is that, well, they also damage and impair protein production in the normal cells. They're very toxic. Think about an engine transmission and the gears meshing together. So if the gears don't mesh, then let's suppose you put the clutch in. Now, no matter how hard you hit the drivetrain, it's the cell's not going anywhere because it doesn't, the two things aren't connecting. And that's how a chaperone inhibitor works. Now, as I said, the problem is in the details. So finding a chaperone inhibitor that would work but without having toxicity is kind of a holy grail. And what got me started on this whole cancer background thing, and hang on to your seat because we're about to dive into the weeds a little, was this new prototype drug called KBU-2046. And this is something that can be given orally and that was built by scientists who were trying to find a solution to the problem of a chaperone inhibitor that didn't turn off the stuff we didn't want turned off. And they found a key. They found a compound that only fits into those chaperone proteins that are made by cancers. Turns out, of course, it's not a single protein. It's a dimer. And one part of this dimer, this other half of the protein is a molecule that is, strictly speaking, only manufactured in cancers because it's running that primitive embryologic DNA. So it isn't present in adult cells that are running the proper software. It looks very, very promising, and it's very selective to cancer cells. So far, they've been using it in models of cancer in mice, and it's shown very effective. It's shown itself to be very effective. It actually seems to be working to inhibit metastasis, decrease bone destruction in existing metastases, and prolong survival at very, very low blood concentrations that are achieved with oral administration. So this is going to make this a very effective cancer suppressor drug. And the platform for humans, yeah, that's 5 or 10 years away. But the concept, I thought, was extremely important. We've gotten to the point, my friends, where we can actually go after a molecule, we can specify the properties, and then build it. And it's just amazing. What are some of the other metabolic targets that we use in cancer nowadays? Well, hormones, right? You've all heard of people being on Lupron or aromatase inhibitors for their breast cancer or for their prostate cancer. Lupron's actually a gonadotropin-releasing factor inhibitor, but same difference. It's hormone deprivation therapy because the hormones work as growth factors for many cancers. That has some side effects, hot flashes, anyone, but is non-toxic at the level of death. There's also a really great drug called Gleevec. This is a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. It was developed to treat CML, which is a type of adult leukemia that's associated with something called the Philadelphia chromosome. Well, it turns out that if you have the Philadelphia chromosome, you've only got one tyrosine kinase. Now, what's that? Well, that's an enzyme that puts phosphorus on an amino acid. Turns out to be really important. Taking phosphorus off and putting phosphorus on things runs our metabolism and our physiology. It's just the nuts and bolts, like a question mark or a period at the end of the sentence. It's absolutely critical to making any sense of instructions. So you can see from what I'm saying that current cancer research focuses on finding the Achilles heel of the individual cancer in question. So as these drugs have been developed, something very, very interesting has turned out to be the case. These metabolic weaknesses reappear in many different cancers. So many people's specific version of breast cancer or lung cancer might have only one version of tyrosine kinase and be treatable with Gleevec. It's not just lung cancer or breast cancer or colon cancer anymore. It's your lung cancer has these particular metabolic vulnerabilities based on the software those cells are running, and we can target those with our new cancer therapies without having a devastating effect on normal tissue. So just to wind this up, on the thread of creative biochemistry, I want to talk about one of the most ancient forms of life that is the master biochemist in existence, and that's the kingdom of fungi. Beer and bread powered the building of the Egyptian pyramids. Both of these are byproducts of these creative biochemists. Fungi produce the most amazing variety of chemicals for their own purposes that you can possibly imagine. And if you go and look at pictures, and I'm posting I will give you a reference for a really good review article about mushrooms as anti-cancer therapy. It's quite technical, but in the first few pages, there's some pictures of these molecules, and they are the most elaborate kind of biochemical macrame you ever saw. That they're just they're like skeleton keys for mammalian physiology. So in cancer, these elaborate structures, mostly lots and lots of benzene rings, can control cells, and that includes cancer cells. And what's really fascinating is that many of the compounds found in mushrooms actually replicate some of the vulnerabilities I've talked about before. So, for example, angiogenesis. There are lots of anti-angiogenesis, anti-VEGF compounds in mushrooms. And Avastin, a drug that's used for cancer because it's a VEGF inhibitor, also it's injected into people's eyes for macular degeneration. And, oh, that's a creepy thought. But there are compounds that do this in mushrooms. There are compounds that inhibit mitosis. There's compounds that produce a concentration of reactive oxygen species locally, which cancer cells have a very, very hard time dealing with. And there's even this topoisomerase, the Gleevec-like drug, which is a DNA repair agent that can be impaired by mushrooms. So, as I said, I'm going to give you the review article. I found it on the NIH.gov website, /PMC/articles/PMC339609. And when I get around to posting the podcast for this web show, I will definitely, when I get around to posting the podcast for this radio show, I will go ahead and put that up there for those of you who are interested in the topic. But my friends, it's worth reading if you or someone you love has cancer, because the specific data on what doses that are achievable with oral dosing, what concentrations that are achievable with oral dosing can achieve in both humans and in animal models for cancer is nothing short of spectacular. Let's go to some email. This one from Michaela in Monterey. Elective surgery to prevent recurrent bouts of diverticulitis is the subject. Hi, I was referred to you by acupuncturist Marion Bloom in Monterey. I suffered two episodes of diverticulitis within 2 months, with the second bout landing me in the hospital for 10 days for microperforations in the sigmoid colon with uncontrolled pain. I was treated conservatively with complete bowel rest and IV Zosyn, but I also contracted C. difficile from that hospital stay, so I was on antibiotics for over 3 months as a result of the diverticulitis and the C. diff. Since then, a colonoscopy showed diverticulosis in the sigmoid and two areas in the right colon. I only had it in the sigmoid colon 3 years ago, with no diverticulitis at all until February. No current infection or inflammation in the colon, but my question is, would you recommend a colon resection of the sigmoid colon now? So, Michaela, in general principle, I would have to say we can't give out direct medical advice for something like this. And also, there really isn't enough information here to give you advice. There are circumstances where I would recommend a colon resection, but I'd really need to see your films. You could schedule a consultation with me. And the office number is 831-421-0197. And you can also find that on the website. You can go to askdrdon.com, even in link to the practice. This next email is from Drew in Lake Forest, California. I've read some amazing things about the form of niacin called NAD positive. In lab mice, it reversed insulin resistance, corrected fatty liver disease, and seems to slow the aging process. I guess if I had a pet mouse, I'd want him to take NAD positive. But what about us humans? There doesn't seem to be a lot of human testing data. Is the hype ahead of the science? Love your show. Well, I think what you're talking about, Drew, is riboside dinuclease, which is a supplement that is been showing a lot of interesting properties as an anti-aging agent because it mimics calorie restriction. So we know, for example, from studies that if we don't feed mice 100% of what they'd like to eat, if we calorie restrict them and give them extra vitamins so they don't get deficiency diseases, they're lean and mean and they live a long time. And going into the DNA, what we find is that these mice have upregulated a piece of DNA called SIRT1. And the SIRT1 gene is very much the same thing that gets turned on with calorie restriction. And it's very suggestive that this is an evolutionary survival mechanism. What does not destroy you makes you stronger, but it's triggering the production of this stress DNA, which is very helpful for longevity. So there have been studies looking at hypertension. I'm unaware or could not find, although I looked, any kind of study for fatty liver. And I think that what I was able to find online was a little self-serving because, of course, this is a commercial product. So I think that there's probably good reason to take something like this if you have those diseases. If you don't have those diseases and you're wondering if this would work, there is a blood marker for activation of the SIRT1 gene. And so what you could do is you could get your telomeres checked, which is the little caps on the end of your chromosomes. And if your SIRT1 gene is activated, then your telomeres will get longer. So that's a way of figuring out whether the drug is working for you, and at a cost probably of, not drug, sorry, supplement, probably cost you a couple $100 for each test. So, but given that the stuff is relatively expensive, call it $40 a month. If you're going to be taking it for years and years, doing the testing to see if it works in you, yeah, seems to me to not be an illegitimate thing to do. I'm going to go to callers now. We have Ben in San Jose. Hello,
hey,
Ben.
Hey, doctor.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm here. How you doing?
Hi. I'm doing great.
Good. Hey, a couple questions for you. Are you familiar with Dr. Klinghardt up in Seattle?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. It's hard not to be if you float around in alternative medicine circles. Go ahead.
Yeah. So was it you? Okay. I'm trying to identify the show or the individual on KSCO a while back that had suggested that he had gone over to Germany for, I guess, to take a look at some new chelation techniques, and that he then actually undergone some himself, and they found that even with all his knowledge, he still had some excessive aluminum in his body. Was that you that mentioned that?
No, it wasn't, but I am familiar with Klinghoffer, and I am pretty familiar with chelation. Do you have a specific question about the topic?
Yeah, I do, actually. In regards to non-mercury, particularly barium,
mm-hmm.
So I have high levels of barium, and it's been speculated that, well, how did you get high levels of barium? And they're toxic levels. That, of course, I had high levels, also toxic levels of mercury, and which of course causes leaky gut. And when you have leaky gut, you know, you have all kinds of digestive issues. That I went in for a GI series. And, of course, they give you barium, you know, for contrast. And the barium, which is supposed to exit your system, leaked through the leaky gut, got into my system. The mercury, believe it or not, is pretty much gone. But the barium levels, even after trying several different approaches, including EDTA and DMPS IVs, the EDTA I thought would be a good match for the barium. But what I've been told is that the magnesium-based EDTA is significantly more effective in removing barium than the calcium-based, and I've been getting calcium-based EDTAs. Do you have any thoughts or, you know, that you want to share about that with me? Or?
Well, I'm wondering where it, you know, you have to look at your sources in terms of, okay, who says that, you know, one is better than the other. I don't generally use that level of, you're doing intravenous, I'm assuming?
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm not, I haven't done like the A4M or the other people, I can't remember their name, that do the educational thing to make you into the someone who does IV chelation. IV chelation needs to be a specialty, and I'm more of a super generalist. But in terms of one question you have to ask is the accuracy of your assessment method and its reliability from test to test. And so there's a complicating factor there. In other words, you can have one level of barium that comes out with I presume that you're doing some kind of provoked test to figure out what your levels are.
Hair test.
Right. Hair test, I recommend that you back your hair test up also with a urine test. And here's why. You could do, the Quiksilver company has a tri-test, which does hair and urine and blood. And different people genetically will have different properties in terms of, for example, if you do a urine test on a child with autism, you'll get high levels of mercury and lead for, compared to an age-matched cohort. But there won't be any in their hair, because one of the features of autism, oddly enough, is that you don't put heavy metals into your hair. So if you don't put barium, if you put barium into your hair preferentially, you may actually have less of a of an accumulated body burden than you realize, because you're getting rid of it in your hair. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, but what source would possibly get barium in my hair?
Well, the barium in your hair is coming from the fact that you're making your hair out of your bloodstream.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
So if I'm good at putting something out in poop, because I put it into bile,
right,
I'm
going
to have high levels of metal in my poop, but I may not have any in my fat. I might have a lot of mercury in my poop, but I might be really good at getting rid of it. My fat might not have high levels.
Yeah, but the thing is that with the hair tests, is I've been getting them every 3 months, and they've been very consistent over a long period of time, a couple of years.
Yeah,
they'll show toxic levels.
Well, that's just it. You need to validate that you're not a hyper excreter.
A hyper excreter meaning what specifically?
A hyper excreter means that if you've got any barium that's coming into your system, it's going into your hair, but it's not staying in you. Unless you have a study that shows that your barium levels in your hair were normal before you had the leaky gut and the barium enemas and that you're, you know, attributing your toxicity to. But my guess is that it went the other way. You said, okay, I have barium in my hair. Where could it have come from? Oh, okay, I've got my cognitive model of how I got that. But the first thing you need to do is validate that you actually have a body burden, and the hair doesn't prove a body burden because of it very well could be that you have a body burden, but you want to make sure, because if the hair is not changing, then you got to go back to square one. So that's my advice for you.
So you're inferring try a provoked urine test and see what the numbers say.
Yeah. Yeah, either a provoked urine or, like I said, the Quiksilver company does a tri-test for testing for metals, and they test all three things.
You have to get that done through a doctor, right?
Oh, probably.
Yeah, because if there's blood involved, obviously, you know.
Well, you're in San Jose, so it's not. There's plenty of functional medicine doctors around. I'm sure you could find somebody who would order it for you.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, doctor.
Good luck to you. Bye-bye. Here's a quick one from Marcia in Charleston, West Virginia. I love the fact that because of the website and the podcast, we hear from all over the country and sometimes all over the world. Okay, leg cramps. My husband is diabetic and takes 1,000 milligrams of metformin twice a day. That's a pretty high dose. He exercises and suffers with severe leg cramps. On advice of doctor, he increased his fluid and stretches. His doctor has no other suggestions. He also takes Lipitor. Neep, 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 neep. That's my sound effect, not in the email. Do you have any suggestions to help him avoid leg cramps? Is there a correlation with metformin or Lipitor? Well, okay, first thing with leg cramps is magnesium, magnesium, magnesium. You start out with that and try to take about between 1,000 and 1,200 milligrams. Usually you'll have to do that in three divided doses, like 300 or 400 three times a day. Secondly, muscle cramps and Lipitor go way back. They have a long, long history. And that's because in some people, the statin drugs will trigger a kind of crisis in the mitochondria of the muscles, and they'll get muscle cramps after exercise. And this is actually muscle damage, so it's not a great thing. You see, the statins turn off CoQ10, and so if your husband isn't taking CoQ10, he may have created a problem with this. So typically what I will do, and I don't think that I need to worry about giving this level of advice over the phone, is you go on a drug holiday for 2 weeks, because 2 weeks of high cholesterol isn't going to kill you. And then during that time, you take big doses of CoQ10, and then you restart your statin. You sort of saturating your cells with the CoQ10, and then you restart your statin at a low dose, and you see if the cramps come back. So CoQ, what I mean by high dose, about 300 milligrams twice a day of ubiquinol with an OL, Q-nol, which you can get at Costco. I don't know if you have Costco in West Virginia, is a good one. And while we're on the topic of CoQ10, friends, I just saw an article that showed that if you rub CoQ10, if you have gum pockets where you've got deep pockets in your gums and periodontitis, if you rub CoQ10 in there after flossing, you can actually show a reduction in reactive oxygen species and a narrowing of these pockets. So I'm definitely going to try that on that one stubborn four that I've got no matter what I do. And I'll tell you, I wear a halo on the flossing, but I still can't get that sucker to shrink. Okay, back to Marcia's letter here. Is there a correlation with metformin and cramping? Not necessarily, but there is an indirect correlation between metformin and B12-related neuropathy. So if you're on metformin, you should be taking a B-complex because it does interfere with the production of B vitamins. And, of course, that's a pretty important thing. Our next email comes from Andrea in Porter, California. Immunosuppressants drugs. I heard you talk about cyclosporin A as an immunosuppressant med. I was prescribed mycophenolate 500 milligrams four times a day for a chronic skin condition called pruritus nodularis. How dangerous is this drug? I'm concerned that I will be subject to infection while taking it. I have genetically low leukocytes, which might further increase my risk of infection. Is it more or less dangerous than cyclosporin? Same or worst risks? Well, Andrea, first of all, cyclosporin is another drug was approved. Let's get on to why was it approved. It was approved to prevent transplant organ rejection. So if you've had an organ transplant and you've got to keep that thing from being rejected, well, you've got a big problem, and it sort of makes sense that the FDA would let you use a drug that was maybe a little more dangerous in that circumstance. That maybe if it was a drug that we were using to treat, itchy bumps on the skin, the FDA would say, you know, itchy bumps on the skin are not going to kill you. Losing that transplanted kidney will. I don't think we want to allow a drug that can cause, well, greater than 1% of people will get diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, joint pain, infections, low white count, anemia, because this is an immunosuppressant and a bone marrow agent. It's also commonly associated with fatigue, headache, cough, breathing issues, and it can cause thrombophlebitis and thrombosis and GI bleeds and invasive CMV brain infection, as well as increasing your risk for pulmonary fibrosis and a host of other malignancies. Some of these occurring in rates of like 1 in 20 people on the drug. This is just not a drug for an annoying skin condition, which is when I read about prurigo nodularis, it's an annoying skin condition with bumps that are itchy. And I'm wondering, have you been checked for the things that are associated with it, like atopic dermatitis, renal failure, hyperthyroidism? Has anybody checked your thyroid? Iron deficiency anemia, another thing that might be missed. Stomach cancer, lymphoma, leukemia, hepatitis B and C, all of these things have been associated with your quote-unquote benign skin condition. But even if it is just the skin condition, you know, you don't want to go here, in my opinion. This is a very, very heavy drug for a not very strong indication. And I think it's a classic case of mission creep, which we see a lot in medical therapy, where a drug is, well, it's a good drug for one thing, but then it kind of starts to get more traction for other indications. But this is not a drug you need to be taking for a benign condition. Let's go to William from New Orleans. And William writes, unexplained weight gain. I am a 55-year-old white male in very good health. I'm physically fit and have no medical issues. However, I have in the past few months inexplicably gained 20 pounds around my entire midsection, despite the fact that I do not overeat. In fact, I quite often consume less on a given day than my partner, who weighs 115 pounds. I'm 6'1", and my normal weight's 185. I'm up to over 204 now. I don't smoke. I have not been on any medications for an extended period of time. However, if I had to guess when this began, I would say that it started after several intensive rounds of antibiotics due to a septic finger injury. The plot, my friends, thickens. I am on pre and probiotics and have been on for more than 3 months. I believe I take high-quality supplements. My diet is free of artificial ingredients and preservatives. I tend to eat a low-carb, low-sugar, whole food diet. I do not drink more than a couple times a week, and when I do, never to excess. I max out at one or two drinks or so. For the last month or so, I've had intense sleep disturbance. I cannot remember the last time I had a good 8 hours. I've had a good deal of blood work done through my GP, and all my hormone and thyroid levels are normal. I've also had MRIs and CAT scans, and I appear to be free of brain tumors. Bottom line, I need to understand why I've gained this seemingly unlosable weight. I have taken great pains to get rid of it, lots of exercise, restricting calories, no sugar, no dairy, no gluten, and I still cannot shift it. Well, I pretty much have no doubt in my mind, William, that the antibiotics played a role. And I think that what happened was that you shifted your flora in an adverse direction. One thing that I would be super curious about is whether or not you have high levels now of Akkermansia mansoni, which is we're starting to actually get on a first name basis with these bacteria now. And this is one that, while nominally healthy, does actually increase your ability to gather calories from what you eat. So it improves the efficiency of your digestion, which if you're eating higher fat foods, even healthy fats, they might be creating, you might be literally gaining more calories for those. A dysbiosis could certainly explain some of it. And when you develop the weight gain, I think that now you have a second factor feeding in, and that's your sleep disruption. I'm really strongly urging you to get a sleep apnea study, maybe get a tracker device as well, because the sleep apnea is potentially giving you a squirt of cortisol multiple times during the night, which is both keeping you awake and also potentially stressing your system. Bad sleep will cause a problem with weight gain. Even if you are doing all the right things, it shifts your metabolism and raises your cortisol levels. So a cortisol curve, which is a saliva curve, those are widely available on the internet, and most of the ones are pretty decent. I like the one from Genova, but there are other labs that will do it. Looking at your cortisol curve would be important. I bet you did not get a 3-hour glucose tolerance test. We need to see what your insulin levels are, because if you're insulin resistant, then use of insulin sensitizers, and these would be things like alpha lipoic acid at a dose of maybe 300 milligrams a day, higher doses of omega-3 fatty acids can also be insulin sensitizers. Cinnamon's another one. Nopal, which is a compound that is in cactus plants, and that's used as a vegetable in Latin America. So these are all things that have insulin sensitizing properties. And if you have elevated insulin levels, even if they're in the high normal range, then that would be one thing for you to address. But you, my friend, have got to get your sleep fixed. And I'd recommend the sleep apnea study, because I don't want you taking sedative agents that worsen the sleep apnea, because then you're just going to be on the same merry-go-round and not getting what you need. Shifting your flora back, well, you might actually have to take antimicrobials under the guidance of someone who knows how to gut garden. You might need a master gardener for the gut to help you get back to the flora that you had before. Right now, stool transplants are homegrown, shall we say, and with very few exceptions, I haven't seen a lot of people be very successful in their homegrown efforts, although I've certainly seen a at least a half dozen people try since we started thinking about the microbiome. I think that's coming down the line, changing your diet in the way that is in sync with where you want to go. And your diet is already good, but maybe what you need to do is something different. I'm not prepared to advise you on that without seeing a stool study, but thought things to consider might be a ketogenic diet or a full-on Atkins to see if you can shift the flora. Like I said, I would probably be looking at antimicrobials, but with this history and these circumstances, the first thing I'd be looking at is hormones, and that would include insulin and cortisol, and not just thyroid, and looking at the gut. So I hope that's been helpful to not just you, but other people who may be dealing with that really nasty problem of unexplained weight gain. Never much fun. So let's see. I'm going to go to a couple of stories here to wrap things up, because I think we've done enough email. This one's a good one, and I think I'd like to put this out because this is quite unexpected. The Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York recently examined the brains of 49 men and 49 women who regularly played soccer in an amateur league. So far as they could tell, both sets of players had headed the ball roughly the same number of times over the preceding season, but scans showed women had 5 times, that's 500% more brain damage than men, with affected brain matter in 8 regions of the brain rather than just the 3 that men had evidence of brain damage in. This is really astonishing and quite unexpected. We don't know why, but the researchers speculated that maybe women have smaller, less muscular necks, and so they may get more rotational force to their heads, in other words, banging the inside of their brain around for longer because this neck didn't absorb so much of the shock. But this is it's well substantiated. It's very scary. And if I had a girl child in a soccer league, I'd be thinking twice about that just based on this research. Let's leave it with ginger. Ginger is right there in the supermarket. Just about every supermarket has it. This study was a double-blind study looking at people undergoing chemotherapy for cancer, which tends to make you very nauseated. They gave them 300 milligrams of ginger extract, 5% gingerols, for those of you who are going to look at it standardized form, versus placebo. They gave them for 5 days per chemo cycle. They got them just on the day of chemo. They compared the two groups. There was a substantial improvement in nausea with the ginger group, not with the placebo. 0.03 significance for the nausea, overall quality of life 0.02, and way, way less fatigue, significance of 0.006, which means there is a 6 in 10,000 chance that this was due to chance. Now that's some statistical significance there, my friend. Oh, I'm sorry, 6 in 1,000, I take it back. So anyway, big deal on ginger. It's good stuff. And if you're feeling a little nauseated, maybe the first thing you should do is cut off a couple of slices of a fresh ginger root, which you, of course, have in your kitchen because it is an anti-cancer spice, and everybody should be throwing it in their food, you know, once a day if they possibly can. And throw some hot water on it and have a cup of tea. That may be all you need. It's natural and doesn't have any adverse side effects like we might be concerned of.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.